Solomon Nduli telephoned Michael Courtney at his desk in the newsroom. "I have something for you," he told Michael. "Can you come out to the Assegai offices right away?" "It's after 5 already," Michael protested, "and it's Friday night. I won't be able to get a pass to enter the township." "Come," Solomon insisted. "I will wait for you at the main gate." He was as good as his promise, a tall, gangly figure in steel-rimmed glasses, waiting under the street lamp near the main gates. And as soon as he slipped into the front seat of the company car, Michael passed him his cigarette pack. "Light one for me as well," he told Solomon. "I brought some sardine and onion sandwiches and a couple of bottles of beer. They're on the back seat." There was no public place in Johannesburg, or in the entire land, for that matter, where two men of different colour could sit and drink or eat together. Michael drove slowly and aimlessly through the streets while they ate and talked. "The PAC are planning their first big act since they broke away from the ANC," Solomon told Michael through a mouthful of sardine and onion. "In some areas they have built up a strong support. Into the Cape and the rural tribal areas, even in some parts of the Transvaal, they have pulled in all of the young militants who are unhappy with the pacifism of the old men. They want to follow Moses Gama's example and take on the nationalists in a head-on fight." "That's crazy," Michael said. "You can't fight Sten guns and Saracen armoured cars with half bricks." "Yes, it's crazy, but then some of the young people would prefer to die on their feet than live on their knees." They were together for an hour, talking all that time, and then at last Michael drove him back to the main gates of Drake's farm. "So that's it then, my friend," Solomon opened the car door. "If you want the best story on Monday, I would suggest you go down to the Vereeniging area. The PAC and Poco have made that their stronghold on the Witwatersrand." "Everton?" Michael asked. "Yes, Everton will be one of the places to watch," Solomon Nduli agreed. "But the PAC now have a new man in Sharpeville." "Sharpeville?" Michael asked. "Where is that? I've never heard of it." Only 12 miles from Everton. I'll find it on my road map." "You might think it worth the trouble to go there," Solomon encouraged Michael. "This PAC organizer in Sharpeville is one of the party's young lions. He will put on a good show, you can count on that." Manfred de la Rey asked quietly,
"So, how many reinforcements can we spare for the stations in the Vaal area?"
General Darny LaRue shook his head and smoothed back the wings of silver hair at his temples with both hands.
"We have only 3 days to move in reinforcements from the outlying areas, and most of those will be needed in the Cape. It will mean stripping the outlying stations and leaving them very vulnerable."
"How many?" Manfred insisted.
500 or 600 men for the Vaal,"
Darny LaRue said with obvious reluctance.
"That will not be enough," Manfred growled. "So we will reinforce all stations lightly, but hold most of our forces in mobile reserve and react swiftly to the first hint of trouble."
He turned his full attention to the map that covered the operations table in the control room of police headquarters in Marshall Square.
"Which are the main danger centres on the Vaal?"
"Everton," Darny LaRue replied without hesitation. "It's always one of the trouble spots. And then Funabale Park."
"What about Sharpeville?"
Manfred asked, and held up the crudely printed pamphlet that he had tightly rolled in his hand.
"What about this?"
The general did not reply immediately, but he pretended to study the operations map as he composed his reply. He was well aware that the subversive pamphlets had been discovered by Captain Lothar de la Rey, and he knew how the minister felt about his son. Indeed, Darny LaRue shared the general high opinion of Lothar, so he did not want to belittle him in any way or to offend his minister.
"There may well be disturbances in the Sharpeville area," he conceded, "but it is a small township and has always been very peaceful. We can expect our men there to behave well, and I do not see any immediate danger. I suggest we send 20 or 30 men to reinforce Sharpeville and concentrate our main efforts on the larger townships with violent histories of boycotts and strikes."
"Very well," Manfred agreed at last. "But I want you to maintain at least 40% of our reinforcements in reserve, so that they can be moved quickly to any area that flares up unexpectedly."
"What about arms?" Darny LaRue asked.
"I am about to authorize the issue of automatic weapons to all units."
He turned the statement into a query, and Manfred nodded.
"Yeah. We must be ready for the worst. There is a feeling amongst our enemies that we are on the verge of capitulation. Even our own people are becoming frightened and confused."
His voice dropped, but his tone was fiercer and more determined.
"We have to change that. We have to crush these people who wish to tear down and destroy all we stand for, and give this land over to bloodshed and anarchy."
The centres of support for the PAC were widely scattered across the land, from the eastern tribal areas of the Siskai and the Transkei to the southern part of the great industrial triangle along the Vaal River, and 1,000 miles south of that in the black township of Langa and Nyanga that housed the greater part of the migrant worker force that serviced the mother city of Cape Town. In all these areas, Sunday the 20th of March 1960 was a day of feverish effort and planning, and of a peculiar expectancy. It was as though everybody at last believed that this new decade would be one of immense change. The radicals were filled with a feeling of infinite hope, however irrational, and with a certainty that the nationalist government was on the verge of collapse. They felt that the world was with them, that the age of colonialism had blown away on the winds of change, and that after a decade of massive political mobilization by the black leaders, the time of liberation was at last at hand. All it needed now was one last shove, and the walls of apartheid would crash to earth, crushing under them the evil architect Verwoerd and his builders who had raised them up. Rally Tabaka felt that marvellous euphoria as he and his men moved through the township, going from cottage to cottage with the same message. "Tomorrow we will be as one people. No one will go to work. There will be no buses, and those who try to walk to the town will be met by the Poko on the road. The names of all who defy the PAC will be taken and they will be punished. Tomorrow we are going to make the white police fear us." They worked all that day, and by evening every person, man and woman, in the township had been warned to stay away from work and to assemble in the open space near the new police station early on the Monday morning.
"We are going to make the white police fear us. We want everybody to be there. If you do not come, we will find you."
Amelia had worked as hard and unremittingly as Raleigh had done. But like him, she was still fresh, unwearied, and excited as they ate a quick and simple meal in the back room of the bakery.
"Tomorrow we will see the sun of freedom rise,"
Raleigh told her, as he wiped his bowl with a crust of bread.
"But we cannot afford to sleep. There is still much work to be done tonight."
Then he took her hand and told her,
"Our children will be born free, and we will live our life together like men, not like animals."
And he led her out into the darkening township to continue the preparations for the great day that lay ahead. They met in groups on the street corners, all the eager young ones, and Raleigh and Amelia moved amongst them, delegating their duties for the tomorrow, selecting those who would picket the road leading from Sharpville to Vereeniging.
"You will let no one pass. Nobody must leave the township," Raleigh told them. "All the people must be as one when we march on the police station tomorrow morning." "You must tell the people not to fear," Raleigh urged them. "Tell them that the white police cannot touch them, and that there will be a most important speech from the white government concerning the abolition of the pass laws. Tell the people they must be joyful and unafraid, and that they must sing the freedom songs that PAC has taught them."
After midnight, Raleigh assembled his most loyal and reliable men, including the two buffaloes from the Shebeen, and they went to the homes of all the black bus drivers and taxi drivers in the township and pulled them from their beds.
"Nobody will leave Sharpville tomorrow," they told them, "but we do not trust you not to obey your white bosses. We will guard you until the march begins. Instead of driving your buses and taxis tomorrow and taking our people away, you will march with them to the police station. We will see to it that you do. Come with us now.
As the false dawn flashed the eastern sky, Raleigh himself scaled a telephone pole at the boundary fence and cut the wires. When he slid down again, he laughed as he told Amelia, "Now our friend the leopard will not find it so easy to call in other police to help him." Captain Lothar de Lerae parked his Land Rover and left it in a sanitary lane in a patch of shadow out of the street lights, and he moved quietly to the corner and stood alone. He listened to the night. In the years he had served at Sharpeville, he had learned to judge the pulse and the mood of the township. He let his feelings and his instincts take over from reason, and almost immediately he was aware of the feral excitement and sense of expectation which had the township in its grip. It was quiet until you listened, as Lothar was listening now. He heard the dogs. They were restless, some close, others at a distance, yapping and barking, and there was an urgency in them. They were seeing and scenting groups and single figures in the shadows, men hurrying on secret errands. Then he heard the other sounds, soft as insect sounds in the night, the whistle of lookouts on the watch for his patrols, and the recognition signals of the street gangs. In one of the dark cottages nearby, a man coughed nervously, unable to sleep, and in another a child whimpered fretfully and was instantly hushed by a woman's soft voice. Lothar moved quietly through the shadows, listening and watching. Even without the warning of the pamphlets, he would have known that tonight the township was awake and strung up. Lothar was not an imaginative or romantic young man, but as he scouted the dark streets, he suddenly had a clear mental picture of his ancestors performing the same dire task. He saw them bearded and dressed in drab homespun, armed with the long muzzle loaders, leaving the security of the lagered wagons, going out alone into the African night to scout for the enemy, the Swart Gevaar, the Black Danger. Spying out the bivouac where the black impis lay upon their war shields, waiting for the dawn to rush in upon the wagons. His nerves crawled at those atavistic memories, and he seemed to hear the battle chant of the tribes in the night and the drumming of assegai on rawhide shield, the stamp of bare feet and the crash of war rattles on wrist and ankle as they came in upon the wagons for the dawn attack. In his imagination, the cry of the restless infant in the nearby cottage became the death screams of the little Boer children at Wienen, where the black impis had come sweeping down from the hills to massacre all in the Boer encampment. He shivered in the night as he realized that though so much had changed, as much had remained the same. The black danger was still there, growing each day stronger and more ominous. He had seen the confident, challenging look of the young blacks as they swaggered through the streets, and heard the warlike names they had adopted, the Spear of the Nation and the Pure Ones. Tonight, more than ever, he was aware of the danger, and he knew where his duty lay. He went back to the Land Rover and drove slowly through the streets. Time and again he glimpsed small groups of dark figures, but when he turned the spotlight upon them, they melted away into the night. Everywhere he went, he heard the warning whistles out there in the darkness, and his nerves tightened and tingled. When he met his own foot-patrolling constables, they also were nervous and ill at ease. When the dawn turned, the eastern sky pale yellow and dimmed out the street lights, he drove back through the streets. At this time in the morning, they should have been filled with hurrying commuters, but now they were empty and silent. Lothar reached the bus terminus, and it too was almost deserted. Only a few young men in small groups lounged at the railings. There were no buses, and the pickets stared at the police Land Rover openly and insolently as Lothar drove slowly past. As he skirted the boundary fence, passing close to the main gates, he exclaimed suddenly and braked the Land Rover. From one of the telephone poles, the cables trailed limply to the earth. Lothar left the vehicle and went to examine the damage. He lifted the loose end of the dangling copper wire and saw immediately that it had been cut cleanly.
he let it drop and walked slowly back to the Land Rover. Before he climbed into the driver's seat, he glanced at his wristwatch. It was 5:10. Officially, he'd be off duty at 6, but he would not leave his post today. He knew his duty. He knew it would be a long and dangerous day, and he steeled himself to meet it. On Monday morning, the 21st of March 1960, 1,000 miles away in the Cape townships of Langa and Inyanga, the crowds began assembling. It was raining. That cold, drizzling Cape northwester blew from the sea, dampening the ardour of the majority. But by 6 a.m., there was a crowd of almost 10,000 gathered outside the Langa bachelor quarters, ready to begin the march on the police station. The police anticipated them. During the weekend, they had been heavily reinforced, and all officers and senior warrant officers issued with Sten guns. Now a Saracen armoured car, in drab-green battle paint, entered the head of the wide road in which the crowd had assembled, and a police officer addressed them over the loudspeaker system. He told them that all public meetings had been banned, and that a march on the police station would be treated as an attack. The black leaders came forward and negotiated with the police, and at last agreed to disperse the crowd, but warned that nobody would go to work that day, and there would be another mass meeting at 6 p.m. that evening. When the evening meeting began to assemble, the police arrived in Saracen armoured cars and ordered the crowd to disperse. When they stood their ground, the police baton charged them. The crowd retaliated by stoning the police, and in a mass rushed forward to attack them. The police commander gave the command to fire, and the Sten guns buzzed in automatic fire, and the crowd fled, leaving 2 of their number dead upon the field. From then on, weeks of rioting and stoning and marches racked the Cape Peninsula, culminating in a massed march of tens of thousands of blacks. This time they reached the police headquarters at Caledon Square, but dispersed quietly after their leaders had been promised an interview with the Minister of Justice. When the leaders arrived for this interview, they were arrested on orders of Manfred de Larey, the Minister of Police. And because police reserves had by this time been stretched almost to breaking point, soldiers and sailors of the Defence Force were rushing in to supplement the local police units, and within 3 days the black townships were cordoned off securely. In the Cape, the struggle was over. In Funderbale Park, 10 miles from Vereeniging, and in Everton, both notorious centres of radical and violent black political resistance, the crowds began to gather at first light on Monday the 21st of March, 1960. By 9 o'clock, the marchers, thousands strong, set out in procession for their local police stations. However, they did not get very far. Here, as in the Cape, the police had been reinforced, and the Saracen armoured cars met them on the road, and the loud hailers boomed out the orders to disperse. The orderly columns of marchers, bogged down in the quicksands of uncertainty and ineffectual leadership, and the police vehicles moved down on them ponderously, forcing them back, and finally broke up their formations with baton charges. Then abruptly the sky was filled with a terrible rushing sound, and every black face was turned upwards. A flight of Sabre jet fighter aircraft of the South African Air Force flashed overhead, only 100 feet above the heads of the crowd. They had never seen modern jet fighters in such low-level flight, and the sight and the sound of the mighty engines was unnerving. The crowds began to break up, and their leaders lost heart. The demonstrations were over almost before they had begun. Robert Sobukwe himself marched to Orlando Police Station in Great Soweto. It was 5 miles from his house in Mofolo, and although small groups of men joined him along the way, they were less than 100 strong when they reached the police station and offered themselves for arrest under the pass laws. In most other centres, there were no marches and no arrests. At Hercules Police Station in Pretoria, 6 men arrived passless and demanded to be arrested. A jocular police officer obligingly took their names and then sent them home. In most of the Transvaal, it was undramatic and anticlimactic. But then there was Sharpeville.